This is The National Conversation with All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro, and each night we're here to answer your questions.
Hi, my name is Karen, and I'm calling from California.
Hi, this is Mike in Tucson, Arizona.
I am a restaurant owner in Portland, Oregon, and I recently purchased my business from another owner.
My question is regarding the cloth face masks that are so popular these days.
My question is, how is the coronavirus affecting the Native American population in the United States?
Do banks, big banks in particular, have to follow a set of rules or guidelines when lending their paycheck protection loans?
How long are asymptomatic carriers of COVID-19 contagious?
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Tonight, we have experts on hand to offer solid facts, tell you what we know, and correct some of the misinformation that's floating around. And when we don't know something, we will tell you that, too. This is our last week answering questions on The National Conversation, at least for the time being. So for the next few days, you can still send us your questions about the pandemic and the way we live now at npr.org/nationalconversation. On Twitter, use the hashtag NPRConversation. Each night, we begin by answering the question, what happened today? The floor of the New York Stock Exchange opened for the first time since the pandemic began. Stocks surged and ended the day up. Biotech company Novavax began human trials of its coronavirus vaccine in Australia this week. The WHO reports it is the 10th vaccine to begin human trials. Deaths in New York were down to their lowest point since tracking started. Governor Andrew Cuomo said, "We grieve the lives lost, but have hope as the death toll steadily drops."
Maybe we don't all run back to the beach, but we're going to turn the page on COVID-19.
The Democratic governor of North Carolina is responding to the president's Twitter threats to pull the Republican National Convention out of Charlotte. Governor Roy Cooper says the state is still waiting on a safety plan from Republicans for their August convention.
I'm not surprised by anything that I see on Twitter. I will say that it's okay for political conventions to be political, but pandemic response cannot be.
The president says he wants a decision from the governor in a week on whether they'll be able to have the full convention or not.
Now, if he can't do it, if he feels that he's not going to do it, all he has to do is tell us, and then we'll have to pick another location. And I will tell you, a lot of locations want it.
In the U.S., there have been nearly 100,000 deaths from COVID-19. Worldwide, more than 5.5 million cases have been identified, and the actual total is almost certainly far higher than that. To help us understand how the disease is affecting the world, NPR's Ping Huang joins us again. She covers global health and development. Good to have you back.
Hi, great to be here, Ari.
Let's start with the relationship between the U.S. and the international community. Last week, President Trump sent a letter to the World Health Organization saying the U.S. may leave the agency because of the WHO's handling of COVID-19. What's been the fallout from that announcement?
Yeah, you're right. So last week, President Trump sent a letter to the head of WHO criticizing the response to the COVID-19 pandemic, and his main issue in the letter is that WHO lacks independence from China. So far, WHO hasn't said a whole lot in response. They've basically said, we've received the letter and we're looking into it. Now, it would be a big deal if the U.S. cut funding and left the World Health Organization, but global health experts point out that it's not really the president's decision to make. Moves like that would have to be approved by Congress. But they say that the letter is still damaging because it's divisive, and it makes it really hard for the agency to focus on dealing with the global pandemic.
Now, President Trump's reasoning focuses on China's lack of transparency when COVID-19 was beginning to spread. What do global health experts say about China's responsibility for the spread of the disease?
So they've been telling me that there is evidence that China was not transparent early on in the outbreak. Some experts told me that Chinese health authorities were probably somewhere between 2 and 6 weeks late in sharing knowledge about the disease with the world. But they also told me that while it might be valid to say China maybe should have reported earlier, it's not quite as valid to say that it's WHO's fault because the organization is governed by its member countries. It's not designed to be independent from China or from the U.S. or from any of its member nations, really. So global health experts say that if we want WHO to actually hold countries accountable, it has to be structured differently.
Okay, let's get some listener questions here. A few people have asked us about how to interpret the global COVID-19 numbers. Here's one of them.
I'm Rick Ackerman from San Diego, California. I listen to NPR, and I hear the statistics for the coronavirus for the various countries in the total numbers. But without knowing the populations of the countries, it's difficult to make sense. I would really like to know what the infection rate is in the population per 100,000.
It's a great question, not just the total number of infections where we know the U.S. is in the lead, but about the infection rate. What does Rick's way of looking at the numbers show us?
Yeah, so Rick's instinct to look at numbers in the context of their population size is a good one. And when you actually look at the number of confirmed cases per capita, the U.S. comes in 10th. We have about 500 confirmed cases per 100,000 people. Now, the thing that you might not expect is that very small countries tend to dominate this list. So the top three countries are San Marino, Qatar, and the Vatican. And Qatar is the largest of those countries that has 3 million people. So I spoke with a couple researchers about comparing per capita rates, and what they told me is that it's actually very hard to compare between countries. Each one has a different testing strategy, and every country is at a different stage in their epidemics, so it doesn't really make for an apples-to-apples comparison, but it might be more useful when you're looking inside a country. So, for instance, China is very low on the per capita list because their population is huge, but definitely some of their cities have had high infection rates, so it might be more useful to compare the per capita infection rates of Wuhan and New York, say, instead of China and the United States.
Interesting. All right, Bette in Colorado has another question about global COVID-19 numbers.
I look at the world map every morning in the newspaper, and it appears that the coronavirus has been very active in selected areas around the globe. Places where the virus has traveled are diverse. Detroit, Michigan, and a small village in the Brazilian rainforest are examples of this. And yet other places, like heavily populated areas in East Africa, appear to be only minimally affected. How can this be so random, or is it?
Yeah, Ping, can you explain why the virus has spread in such inconsistent ways in different parts of the world?
Yeah, it's something that a lot of public health researchers are asking. Why are some places hit really hard and others not as much? And if we take the example of Africa that Bette brought up, the situation in most countries there is much less severe than WHO officials were projecting just a month or two ago. And they think that in the case of Africa, it has to do with a couple factors. So the disease came later to the African region than it did to the US or to Europe. And so physical distancing and travel bans, when they were put in place, they came relatively early in their outbreak. And another reason could be that Africa has a very young population. There's 60% of the people there are under 25, and young people tend to not get as sick from COVID. So WHO officials are cautiously optimistic, but they are also warning that it could just be early days in the epidemic there. The disease could still take off. So they're saying it's a time to be vigilant, and while they are optimistic about the situation, they're still on edge.
That's really interesting and shows how quickly our understanding of this disease is changing. Our next listener question is also about Brazil, which has the second highest number of COVID-19 cases in the world.
Hi, my name is Marina. I'm calling from 29 Palms, California. And I heard on NPR the devastating impact that the coronavirus is having in Manaus, Brazil, which is like one of the most steamy, hot, tropical places you can think of. What does that say about the theory that the virus can't survive in a hot, humid environment?
Yeah, so many people have been asking whether the virus is going to die down in the summer in the United States. Does Manaus disprove that theory?
Well, as Marina said, Brazil is currently the world's number two hotspot for coronavirus. It has around 375,000 confirmed cases, and it's second only to the U.S. And the lack of testing in Brazil probably means that there's a lot more. But Marina's question is about seasonality and whether public health officials expect the virus to naturally dip in summer months. And what WHO is saying is that right now, no, they don't expect to see that because it's a new disease and everyone in the world is pretty susceptible to it. So they expect to see it continue to spread regardless of temperature and season. Now, if COVID-19 sticks around for a long time, we might in the future start seeing cycles of the disease in different seasons, depending on how many people are immune to the virus and how people behave in different times of year. But for now, the virus hasn't gone away naturally in any countries, and places that have managed to suppress it have done it through a lot of hard work and strong public health measures.
Okay. Our next question comes from a listener named Brian in Idaho.
Are there any statistics on the rate of infection in the millions of refugee people in refugee camps and the morbidity rate? Thank you very much.
It's a great question. I mean, we're in one of the largest numbers of displaced people in modern history right now, and refugee camps are so densely populated. What can you tell us about how the disease is being spread in these camps?
Unfortunately, we don't actually have a lot of information right now about what's happening in refugee camps. As you mentioned, people living in these camps are often living in very crowded conditions without good access to toilets and running water. And there have been efforts in some camps to test. There have been so far 24 cases found now at a Rohingya refugee camp in Bangladesh, and now 15,000 people there are quarantined. And camps are trying to do what they can to prepare for the virus. So they're stepping up hand washing stations, they're handing out masks. But statistics on infections and COVID-related deaths among migrants are really hard to come by, and even harder now that the work of many humanitarian groups that are usually in these camps have been put on hold.
That is NPR's Ping Huang, who covers global health and development for NPR. We really appreciate your answering all these listener questions for us.
Thanks for having me, Ari.
And we know that the way we work is going to change dramatically as a result of this pandemic. So if you have questions about the future of work, we want to help. Go to npr.org/nationalconversation. On Twitter, use the hashtag NPRConversation, or you can call and leave us a voicemail message at 202-403-0386. Once again, that number is 202-403-0386. In just a moment, we'll look into how our understanding of COVID-19 has changed over the past few months. You're listening to The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.